You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Good afternoon, Alexis.
Good afternoon.
Great to have you back. I expect Matt back next week after a furious stumping of the great book, Too Dumb to Fail. But I did want to get one more chance to talk to you. I know you're not, you're back in Washington, D.C. today.
Taking Ben Carson's advice, I went home to go do some laundry.
But you were in Iowa, you were in New Hampshire, you will be going to South Carolina for the next stop on the Republican primary trail in your capacity as the National Review's campaign correspondent. But can you tell me what New Hampshire meant to you? Did it work out the way you thought it was going to work out? And what do you think it means for South Carolina?
It did not work out the way I thought it was going to work out, specifically in regards to Marco Rubio, who, I mean, like, that was just completely stunning to me, that he went from being, looking like he was maybe going to win, maybe going to get second, maybe be the strong contender for second, be tied with Kasich, and then all of a sudden just complete collapse after Christie just dismantled him on the debate stage, which, I mean, justifiably collapsed, because I think he really did dismantle Rubio on the debate stage.
So what? So wasn't
the
debate?
I was really surprised.
I've heard some chatter that there was no change in the tracking poll. So perhaps you wouldn't ascribe it to the debate. Maybe he just wasn't that strong in the first place and didn't have the proper ground game. But from your perspective,
so,
it really
I
was
don't know
the
what the internal. I mean, I don't know what the campaign, like, what people were seeing internal polls, but we all came out of Iowa, and I wrote a piece coming out of Iowa that he had the momentum. He was, you know. He looked really good. He looked a lot better than Cruz. He looked a lot better than everyone. He looked like he was just going to kind of coast. And obviously Kasich, you know, was a factor in New Hampshire. He wasn't a factor in Iowa. But Rubio looked like he was going to be, if not second, close third. And that just, I mean, he barely, you know, he came what, fifth behind Jeb.
Right.
Like, losing to Jeb was not what they thought was in the cards. They thought, you know, this was going to be, he was going to have momentum coming out of Iowa. He was going to do really well in New Hampshire. And my colleague Tim Alberta wrote a piece saying that their strategy, as discussed kind of behind the scenes with donors, was a 3-2-1 strategy, was how he put it, that you get third in Iowa, second in New Hampshire, and first in South Carolina, and just kind of rock it out of there. And they have pushed back very hard, insisting that this is a completely made up thing. But Tim is a very good reporter. I feel fairly confident that's not the case. I think they just don't like the way it looks now that they didn't get second in New Hampshire. And first in South Carolina is a little dicey.
Now, I've always thought of Rubio as a lightweight. I never thought he really has shown, there are interviews that he has done, for example, with Fox's Chris Wallace, or the time he said, "I'm not a scientist," about global warming, and kind of dodged on how old the Earth is. I always felt he wasn't that great under pressure, but you might have seen him up close more than I have. Were you surprised at how he responded to Christie's taunts at the debate? Or was there a party that's like, well, yeah, that's Rubio. He can't handle that kind of stuff.
It was a little bit of both. I was surprised in that they knew this was coming. Christie, you know, previewed this attack for days. And mostly Rubio has had very strong debate performances. Like, regardless of how he does in other circumstances, he's been a really good debater. You know, that moment with Jeb was when he completely took apart Jeb in one of the earlier debates was pretty strong. Like, he knows what he's doing when it comes to a debate. It's just, like, I just can't figure out how they weren't prepared for this. That was the baffling part for me. Like, you knew this was coming. They said they knew it was coming. I mean, you know, you talked to them before. They knew exactly that he was in for a really rough ride and that he just kind of had to survive. And they somehow, like, it's like they over-programmed him or something.
Well, he was prepared to respond to Christie by talking about his credit downgrades and his snow shoveling performance. I mean, they had that in his back pocket.
Yeah, I just don't understand how they didn't sit there and say, like, the thing I'm always struck by on the trail, and no longer, alas, but I was always struck by how everyone sits there and says, Rubio's the natural. Christie is a phenomenal campaigner. I mean, clearly there are some flaws. He's out of the race, like, all of that. But the man puts on a town hall like nobody else. I, you know, and reporters always talk about this. We sort of loved covering him because he's fun to watch and he's good at it. And I always would sit there and say, my gosh, why is everyone saying Rubio's the natural? Christie's a million times better, at least at this.
Well, he's a more natural performer.
Yeah.
You know, Rubio...
Well, but he is a performer. Rubio doesn't want to perform. Rubio just wants to sort of, like, say what he has to say, get the exact headline he gets, and walk away.
But, you know, how many people praise Bernie Sanders for being disciplined and on message all the time? He gives the same speech every show. It's a longer speech, but it's the same speech.
No, and like, there's nothing wrong with stay. Like, in fact, it's a good quality for a politician to stay on message and stay in your speech. But you also have to be able to react and like answer questions and I don't know, be able to acknowledge that you shouldn't just repeat your lines over and over and over again. That it just seemed like such an unforced error. Like,
well, what I thought was weird about
responses
it was
instead of one response.
I mean, what's unfair about it is every single person on that stage has talking points and repeats them endlessly in the debate. I mean, Chris Christie has his talking points. Chris Christie doesn't, it's not pure improv every show. There are plenty of things
he
says.
Chris Christie says the exact same thing. You know, he has his parts that he would say, he just rearranges them. But he also, I mean, and I've been to a lot of, I spent the past like 4 days with Chris Christie. So I'm in a, you know, champion Chris Christie mode. But he, you know, people ask him questions and he's not getting the same questions every time and he doesn't answer them. Like he answers, you know, he has his answers, but I watched him, his final town hall on Monday night, which was, you know, sort of like an emotional thing. Like he was going out in style. It went over 2 hours. He just kind of, he kept going. But he got into it with this guy over marijuana and, you know, the guy asked him a question. He was like, no, I think you're wrong. You know, this is why I think you're wrong, blah, blah. And the guy's like, well, let me rebut. He's like, okay, you have 60 seconds. And he let the guy talk for 60 seconds. He's like, okay. And he goes through and he addresses, you know, what the guy is saying point by point. You can't do that if you just hear marijuana and say, you know, the alarm dings in your head and you say, okay, now this is when I say, you know, this is my line right here. And then, you know, the next time someone asks about marijuana, you're like, well, I can't say the same line again, but I'm going to say the same line because this is what I say when someone says marijuana. And that seems to be what Rubio does. He hears, you know, the word and he just goes
right,
and Christie can handle the back and forth. Well, I was surprised that Rubio couldn't.
That agree. What I thought was particularly weird about what Rubio did was, so he was very caught on the whole, you know, Barack Obama knows exactly what he's doing, as a defensive response to the question about his own experience. It's not like it's a sentiment that everybody in the hall already subscribes to. This was Rubio's sort of, you know, idiosyncratic point to defend himself. And then he starts dropping it regardless of circumstance. I mean, that's where it got weird. I mean, I think everyone's used to a politician going back to a point when it is relevant to the discussion at hand. And then he just started spouting it off regardless of what was going on around him.
No, and I also think you have a point that it is a totally idiosyncratic idea. Like, this is not a narrative that anyone had been pushing until now. This is sort of what they seem to come up with to say, well, yes, he's inexperienced, but it's not an issue of inexperience. I mean, I don't know. I feel like if you wanted to have that be the narrative, you had to put that out there before the debate.
Right.
You couldn't just take 30 seconds and be like, hey, new narrative, let's go with this. Everybody keep up.
Now, to acknowledge my own punditry failings here, I've been a Trump skeptic forever. I felt validated after Iowa that he was below expectations relative to polls, but he essentially matched his polls and got a little bit better in New Hampshire. So now everyone is assuming that, you know, the Trump madhouse, all media craziness, no ground game strategy is going to work. And I have to own being wrong with that in New Hampshire. I'm still a skeptic. maybe I can't see the writing on the wall. But I mean, New Hampshire to me does number one. He got about a third of the vote, which is not a majority. I mean, if there was a consolidated establishment candidate at that point, Trump would not have won. You know, Pat Buchanan won New Hampshire 26% in 1996. He is not the nominee. So I'm not convinced that this is the end all be all of how one wins campaigns nationally. But New Hampshire arguably was pretty suited for Trump because Trump is, you know, he actually won the moderate vote in New Hampshire. Like, this is what a Northeast moderate Republican is. Kind of racist. It's not like He is. So, I mean, there's the Kasich kind of New England moderate, and there's the Trump kind of New England moderate. And you know, you listen to Howie Carr, the Boston area talk show host, who is deeply anti-immigrant, always talking about welfare fraud and welfare cheats. That's the kind of thing that New England Republicans get animated about. And Trump talks like, I mean, Trump is from the Northeast. He talks like that kind of guy. So I'm still dubious that's going to play in the rest of the country, especially South Carolina. But I know you're not there yet, but you are closer to the world of Republicans and conservatives than I am. What are people thinking about how he goes to South Carolina? This is Ted Cruz country, a lot of evangelicals like Iowa is. Jeb Bush has a lot of family ties there, a lot of veterans in South Carolina. He's playing the veteran card hard. He's running ads with his brother, but that could play well in South Carolina. Is there some, I mean, the poll hasn't been much polling since New Hampshire, but what's the early talk? Who's got the edge there?
I mean, I think the issue is that everyone could potentially have an edge there. Like you said, Jeb has family ties there. Rubio and Jeb has the endorsement of Lindsey Graham, which is definitely helpful. Rubio has Tim Scott, Trey Gowdy, who are two of the state's most popular politicians. He's got his whole staff has really serious South Carolina ties. His campaign manager, Terry Sullivan, is a South Carolina guy. And, you know, Cruz obviously has the conservative component there. And then Trump just has momentum and apparently like really wide support everywhere that no one can quite classify
It,
accurately.
I mean, those are you mentioned that sort of the top line endorsements that everyone's waiting for the governor, Nikki Haley, to see if she endorses anybody. Are there certain South Carolina operatives that are known to have networks of infrastructure that people can lay claim to?
You know, I mean, I think Rubio's team is very confident of their South Carolina operation. They do, like I said, Terry Sullivan, who's his campaign manager, is he's a South Carolina guy. He has a couple other people whose names I'm spacing out on right now. But I think the issue is really there's a compelling argument for just about for, you know, at least four candidates out there. And Jeb, you know, Jeb put himself back in the race. I'm not sure he put himself back in the race quite with the flying colors they had hoped. The Politico headline out of New Hampshire was Jeb, you know, I'm not dead yet, which is just, I mean, like I sort of read that. I was like, oh man, you good. Way to give the quote of the night. You're not dead yet. Congratulations. But he's not, and that makes him a factor. If I'm remembering correctly, George W. Bush is going to come out on the campaign trail with him later this week. W's really popular out there. That's a really, you know, W has a base out there. So I
I mean,
think
the question
it'll.
is, can the establishment consolidate? So Christie's dropped out. Kasich got
Yes.
second in New Hampshire, but he doesn't have a lot of money, and South Carolina is not good turf for him. Rubio is not coming in with a head of steam, and you know Jeb seems to have the most resources to do to be to win that lane in South Carolina. So even if he's third, maybe he's third behind Trump and Cruz, but if he's putting distance between everybody else, do you start seeing the endorsements and the money roll in? And if Trump Cruz continue to split, is Jeb then the establishment nominee?
I have no idea. I mean, I think they really like, I think this is just bloody and grinding it out for the next, what are we, 10 days until South Carolina? Like,
Right.
I don't think there's anyone with a clear enough edge that you don't just sit there and watch them just obliterate each other. I think Kasich is going to be an interesting factor because I don't think Kasich's going to go anywhere. You talk to the Kasich people, and the interesting thing about the people who surround him is it's a very tight-knit group. They're very attached to him and they're very loyal to him. And so, you know, Jeb is now turning around and kind of going after Kasich because he has to. And that's not necessarily about South Carolina. That's, I think, more about other states down the road. But the Kasich people take that very personally. Matt Borges, who's the chairman of the Ohio Republican Party, told me on the record, he was like, I told all the other candidates to stay out. I told them they should not get involved in Ohio. I told them they should not attack John Kasich in Ohio because it will just come back and bite them in the butt. And it's, you know, Jeb is attacking. And they seem to take it overly personally. And my sense is that if Jeb beats up on Kasich too much, if anyone beats up on Kasich too much, even if Kasich's not in the race by the time Ohio happens, all of his supporters are going to potentially just be very vindictive and be like, "You went after our guy, bring it on. We're gonna go after you."
Now, is
And
there
I
any?
think I think that's more of a future sideline, but it's gonna be a weird dynamic as far as how they handle Kasich.
Now, the Rubio campaign, I think actually Rubio himself today, if my Twitter feed memory is working properly, they're talking openly about a broker convention.
And
They're
that
not.
seems possible.
Well, it's possible, but it's weird for the nominee and the campaign manager to be discussing it, particularly after only two contests. It seems to suggest the only way I can win is if I limp along. Not that I'm going to win a bunch of states, that I'm just going to get a piece here and there and refuse to let anyone else get a bandwagon effect. I mean, it seems to be an odd thing to publicly talk about.
Yeah, it definitely is an odd thing to publicly talk about, but I think Rubio's campaign probably feels like this blew up in their face a little bit. Like this was supposed to, if Rubio had just, gotten second or a close third in New Hampshire, they'd be good. This would be sort of like a glide path to some degree. And it's not. And they have to contend with Jeb. My colleague, Tim Alberto, wrote a great piece about the day of the primary. Before the results came in, he wrote Rubio's nightmare scenario, which is all of a sudden Jeb is back in the game. You have to deal with him. You have to deal with Kasich, and you're like swimming in this much more crowded pool than you thought you'd be in. And that's exactly what happened. I mean, this is everything they thought they could avoid. They want to go one-on-one with Cruz and Trump, or they want to go kind of. One-on-one is with three people in the race. You can't go one-on-one, but
It's a two-headed monster.
Right, but just, if Christie gets out after New Hampshire, Jeb doesn't do well enough to stay in and gets out, and if all you have to deal with is Kasich, Rubio campaign has been, I have an aide on background at some point saying to me, it would be a temporary inconvenience if Kasich stuck around, if Kasich were to beat Rubio in New Hampshire. This is obviously something we talked about before the debate. But Kasich doesn't have the operation, and no, maybe they can pull it off. My sense is he just He, you know, you, to go up against Jeb and Rubio, who have had these operations in place in South Carolina and in states beyond that for just months, for Kasich to suddenly be trying to really compete in that game is maybe not going to go so well. But maybe he pulled it off in Michigan or Virginia or some of these other states where he's sort of got maybe more of an organization. But Kasich was not the one they were worried about. Bush was the one they were worried about. Christie's gone. Kasich, you'll deal with him down the line, but Bush is a problem for them. And, they've spent so much money. It's going to have to be a really compelling demise for Bush to get out. Bush earned now his right to stay in it, and I don't think he's going anywhere because they have organizations straight through kind of the whole thing.
Now, for I'll get to the Democrats in a second. For the Democrats, Nevada's next, and for Republicans, South Carolina's next, and then they reverse and
I
go
didn't
to the
realize
other
that
state.
actually. I had no idea.
Is Nevada important for Republicans? I mean, South Carolina is a sort of rubber match after New Hampshire and Iowa, the first Southern state, deeply conservative state. It hasn't always tipped the balance. I mean, it did for Bush in 2000. It did for McCain in 2008. In 2012, you had the Gingrich surprise after his one bombastic debate performance, which let him hang around for a bit, but obviously didn't get that nomination. But you can certainly see, either Trump or Cruz get to have a second win, which gives them leg up on the conservative side, or Bush or Rubio, get their first win, and that makes their campaigns take off. But Nevada, would Nevada be that important, or is it just kind of a, way station until March 1st, Super Tuesday, which is really when you have thousands of delegates, allocated in one fell swoop?
It's really hard to say with Nevada. So the problem with Nevada, and this has been the problem for the past couple of cycles, is Nevada, the Republican Party is completely dysfunctional. I mean, like new level of dysfunction. The ballots didn't get counted, if I'm remembering correctly, for like 24, 48 hours. Last I heard, there was no actual list of who had caucused in 2012 for a while, or there was a list, but, you know, it was handwritten and they had to transcribe it. Nevada gives a new meaning to sort of problematic early states. And it's, you know, I think a lot of Republicans think that's a shame because it's one of the, it's the, you know, arguably the one of the only early states, I guess South Carolina too, where the demographics are kind of representative of more of the country at large, as opposed to Iowa and New Hampshire, which are predominantly white. Nevada is a very large Hispanic population, but Nevada is a mess. And the polling therefore is a mess because it's really hard to poll when you don't have a good list of who caucused in 2012. And the polling's just been like all over the place and there's been very little of it. So we have no idea. We just don't know. Like Nevada is the one where literally anything could happen.
If Rubio's going to break us, it would be, I mean, he lived in Nevada, right? He has, family
well,
ties.
Well, so yeah, he has family ties. He was a Mormon until some young age. And that's kind of a known quantity out there. I mean, you talk to people out there and they're
this
like,
big
yeah,
Mormon
you know,
population
we know this is
part
of big Mormon population. And you know, they know this is part of his backstory and that's a favorable thing. He's got a lot of endorsements. He and Bush are, I would think, my understanding is he and Bush have kind of the best teams in place out there in terms of endorsements, in terms of operatives. Bush has a big leg up if he's still in the race because he has Romney's guys running his campaign. And Romney just, you know, demolished everyone in Nevada. And a lot of that was the large Mormon population. But arguably, you know, with state party dysfunction, my sense is that the Romney guys probably have the clearest, probably the best data from 2012 of any campaign. And so if Bush is still around, you know, that works to his advantage. But Rubio's got a strong team and Cruz actually is a pretty strong team. So Nevada becomes harder just because the mobilizing is, it's just, I have no intelligent thoughts to say on Nevada. I think Nevada is just like, it's such a mess. It's such a mess. You know, most people think it won't be an early state anymore because they just have not been able to get it together. John Ralston, who's the kind of dean of the Nevada press corps out there, wrote up a few weeks ago that the RNC was sending someone out to Nevada to really help make sure that the caucus, all of the organization was actually happening like it was supposed to, as opposed to just letting the Republican Party handle it, because no one really thinks they can handle it. And so
speaking of
that, that's the struggle with Nevada.
Does having Sanders and Trump win New Hampshire so handily and having Cruz win Iowa, are both parties going to have great incentive to rethink having Iowa and New Hampshire first in this process? I mean, the whole premise was that these were voters who were going to do their due diligence and really put the candidates through their paces. And, you know, both Sanders and Trump did not do the traditional New Hampshire itty bitty town hall thing. They went the big rally route. Neither party establishment is happy that those guys won. There's always been a question on the Democratic side. Why are these two small white states at the front? Well, let's get the more diverse elements of the party in here. Are the stars aligning for both parties to come together and say, you know what, screw these guys. These guys should not be able to blackmail us into keeping them first all the time.
I mean, Reince Priebus has been pretty open about the fact that this is something he'd like to accomplish before his tenure as RNC chairman ends, that he doesn't think Iowa and New Hampshire should be the early states. And I think they're lending some fuel to the fire here by, you know, the whole point is supposed to be that they're supposed to kind of be some kind of, I don't know, that they're supposed to make some sort of choice. I mean, that they're supposed to vet the candidates and you're supposed to get some kind of decision out of this. And I don't think a lot of people think Trump handily winning New Hampshire and basically taking, I mean, no one was talking about who was going to get first place for like the past 4 months. We knew who was going to get first place. Everyone was talking about second place. And I think for a lot of people, that's maybe not a recommendation for why this state should go first.
So let me shift
but
to the.
Obviously, they will fight tooth and nail to hold on to
it. Of course, they will. So let me shift to the Democrats. You know, Nevada's up next. There's some expectation setting happening on the Clinton side. Well, you know, it's not that diverse a state and it's a caucus state. Bernie can do well there. And, you know, John Ralston, who you mentioned, was like, you know, come on, Clinton people, this is not a lily white state. You know, 65% of the participants were white last time, not 95 like in Iowa and New Hampshire. There's Latinos, there's African Americans. The big union, Clinton Union, isn't endorsing anybody. It's not like they're all in the Bernie camp up front. You know, you should be able to be competitive here. Stop kidding yourself. But so there's definitely some, you know, there's long been talk that Nevada and South Carolina are Clinton's firewall. If Bernie can break through in Nevada and he's got two in a row, you might get a lot more deeper panic on the Democratic side setting in. I don't know if you have any initial thoughts about where you think Clinton went wrong or her ability to right the ship at this point.
You know, I'm gonna defer to that on you. I watch Democrats as more of a bystander since I don't really cover them. But it really has been remarkable how poorly this has worked out for her.
My sense of it is you look at the exit poll data on Iowa and New Hampshire. Both those states had Democrat electorates who self-identified as liberal just under 70%, which I believe is a record. In 2008, both those states were in the upper 50s. The Democrat electorate is obviously more liberal than the country at large, but you're getting to the point of like near unanimity. And there's a lot of talk that because Bernie just swept the state in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. Almost every demographic, age, gender, income, education. So there's talk that he is putting together the kind of coalition not only that you would need to win the primary, but to win the general. If he's actually having appeal, you know, upscale and downscale, men and women, liberal and moderate, because he won the moderates too in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
But I would suggest, let's see if that plays out in states where the populace isn't that liberal. There's a question here, you know, has the entire Democratic electorate shifted left by 10, 15 points since 2008? Maybe that's true, you know, down the line. And if that is the case, you know, Bernie would be in better shape than people would assume. But if, you know, the biggest delegate prize on March 1st is Texas, which in 2008 was 38% liberal. So even that's going up by 10 points. That's still, it's like, you know, Bernie literally wins every single liberal vote. Clinton wins some of them. But it does give you a sense of what those populations are like. Presumably Bernie's going to have tougher challenges, not just that these populations will be less liberal, but they're also, you know, particularly on March 1st, heavily Southern, heavily African-American. He's just untested there. Now, if he might make the inroads, you know, he's got the Cornel West endorsement. He has the Harry Belafonte endorsement. He's certainly trying to play up his civil rights background from when he was a college student, and he's trying to weave in a lot of themes about race in his economic stump. So obviously it would be foolish to presume it is impossible, but I don't think you can take New Hampshire as proof that that coalition that he built applies in these other states. Where I think it is, so even if that's correct, that he can't win in a lot of other places, he's still, and I should have a piece coming out on Politico soon on this subject, he can still win a lot of delegates. If he has the youth vote, you know, in full, which he practically did in Iowa and New Hampshire, you're talking like, you know, 85% kids under 30, young adults under 30.
Mm-hmm.
If that holds throughout the contest, and it's understood that him having delegates gives him power and influence inside the party, so you have reason to keep voting for him, even if he is losing. The way none of the states for the Democrats are winner take all. Everybody, you know, you get a car, you get a car, you get a delegate, you get a delegate. That's how it works. And even more so, the delegates are distributed by congressional district as well as statewide. So most delegates are done district by district. How well did you do in the New Hampshire first district? How well did you do in the New Hampshire second district? And each district, in most cases, has four, five, or six delegates to give away. So in many cases, if you're in a 4-delegate district or a 6-delegate district, you get a lot of even splits. You win by one vote, it's an even split. If it's a 5-delegate district, you get a lot of 3-2s. You have to win by a lot. You have to get 63% or higher, sometimes over 70%, to get a real wide delegate split at the district level. And then now the overall winner gets an extra bunch from the statewide count. But 2/3 of the delegates are done on this district by district basis. So if Clinton could beat Sanders handily in a lot of these states on March 1st, beat him by 10 points, he's still going to get a lot of delegates. Yeah. And if you go into the convention with a lot of delegates, you can have a lot of demands. Your people can say, well, he should be vice president, or Elizabeth Warren should be vice president. Or the way the Democratic convention works, if you're on the platform committee, you get roughly the same amount of delegates on the platform committees. And so let's say he's got 40% of delegates on the platform committee. He can force a minority report of the platform and then take that minority report to the full floor and ask that the floor endorse the minority report. I demand that the convention hall endorse my plan to break up the banks. Or endorse single-payer healthcare, or endorse a carbon tax. That kind of stuff might seem kind of inside baseball. Who cares about platforms anymore? But you have some examples where this got dicey. Jesse Jackson, who had 26% of delegates, just enough to make noise about the platform, forced a minority report on having a Palestinian state, which is a position that now everybody has, but 30 years ago it was highly controversial, so that was a little touchy. The most dramatic example is 1948, when Hubert Humphrey, who was a Senate candidate at that point, took the minority report embracing civil rights. This is a time where there's a whole bunch of Dixiecrats in the Democratic Party. He forced a floor vote on the minority report for civil rights. He wins the vote narrowly. And the Dixiecrats literally get up and walk out of the convention. And that's how Strom Thurmond then ran as Dixiecrat and left the party. This is a dramatic example. Like, he changed the party on that day. That day, the Democrats became a civil rights party, never to be changed again. Bernie would be living for that kind of moment to prove that he is the heart and soul of the party. And the more delegates he wins, even if he doesn't become the nominee, is a step closer to that goal. So I think New Hampshire, no matter what happens in Nevada or beyond, I have a hard time seeing how Murray doesn't get a lot of delegates at this point if he has this rock solid base of support that's not going to go away.
Yeah, I mean, I think given the kind of fervor behind Bernie's, or the fervor of Bernie supporters, that he has an impact no matter what. I mean, she said in that debate, the first person I'd call if I win the nomination is Bernie Sanders and ask his advice. And I think she won't have a choice. I mean,
Dukakis had to meet with Jesse Jackson 3 times.
Yeah.
And I think she'll
have to do the same thing.
Right.
I don't see how she, if she does win the nomination, which I guess still looks likely. I'm a bystander more on Democratic politics, but if she wins, she has to contend with him, and she has to contend with kind of the force that has grown up behind him that is in favor of what he's advocating. Otherwise, she's not going to have the kind of support she needs.
Which is tricky because they don't agree on stuff. I mean, there's a fair amount of overlap, but there's certain things where there just isn't. And you can only dance around this stuff so much, and it comes into how flexible is he going to be when he, and the more delegates he has, the less flexible he needs to be.
Right.
He's always been kind of a team player for Democrats. He's never pushed a spoiler candidate in the presidentials. He never backed Ralph Nader. He sometimes complains about the two-party duopoly and, wanted to primary Obama for a little bit, but, he doesn't push that hard. How far he wants to push come convention time is a big wild card.
Yep. We will see. It's been fascinating to watch. I mean, I have friends who don't follow politics closely, and one of them emailed me the other day. She's like, I admit I haven't been watching this very closely, but I don't understand. Since when does everyone hate Hillary Clinton? I think if you're not, it was just sort of that this is so not what people had anticipated,
What's
6 months
very
ago, I
interesting
guess.
to me is I feel like, I mean, there's always been a debate in liberal corners how liberal the Clintons are. Are these people who are steadfastly progressive but made compromises because they needed to along the way, because they're political animals and they calculate to get by, but by and large they still did things that were for the greater good. And we should be mad about how the media and the Republicans, caricature them and treat them terribly for doing the kinds of things that every other politician does. And there's a hard left critique of them, which is they were in hock to the Reubenites, the Wall Streeters. They deregulated Wall Street. They passed Glass-Steagall repeal. They push welfare reform, and they are they're soulless. They lack political conviction, and we don't want their kind in the party, or certainly not controlling the party. And it really feels for a while that critique was a relatively quiet critique. I don't think the average Democrat really subscribed to that. And even Obama, he played upon that to some degree in the primary, but he didn't really relitigate the 90s era Clinton all that much. I mean, there are certain quote unquote dog whistles to that end, but it was more about hitting Hillary on her own record, her own Iraq vote, to win that contest. The under 30 crowd, who weren't alive or barely paying attention when the Clintons were around, they seem to have learned the hard left critique, and that is their understanding of the Clintons period. And so there is a tweet storm by David Roberts, who writes for Vox, who is, I believe, in my age cohort, in his 40s, and not known for being, a squish in liberal corners. He went on this whole tweet storm ranting about, youngsters lecturing him about 90s Eric Clinton policies. And he was like, "Look, you don't know the political context that welfare reform was done in. Don't read a blog post and lecture me about that. If you when you when 23-year-old Bernie Bros do that, you get lectured by old." That's what he said. So there, most of the early blogosphere are people who cut their teeth on defending Clinton against right-wing nonsense. But there's a generational divide there, because if you're 25 years old, you weren't doing that. So that's a really hard thing for Hillary to undo. I mean, if that's just being internalized by younger liberals, you can rationalize and explain all day long. They're just not going to hear it. And that's why I think the pragmatist card that Hillary's trying to play just co totally falls flat with that audience. They don't believe it's necessary. They want more than what they've gotten from Obama. And hearing about how you cut a deal on foster care with Tom DeLay in 2002 is unimpressive to that crowd. There's a fundamental lack of trust there. So the hope for her is that there aren't enough of those voters to make a difference when she gets into the bigger states. But I think there's a part of the party that she's just kind of lost right now and will have a hard time getting back.
I agree.
We should wrap up. I would point folks to one other thing that I wrote this week, where I dare to make the case for corporate campaign cash in Real Clear Politics. It's called "Why It's Okay to Take Wall Street Campaign Cash." And I talk about how, Barack Obama took Wall Street money, FDR took Wall Street money, Teddy Roosevelt took Wall Street money, Woodrow Wilson took Wall Street money, and all those guys regulated corporations and regulated Wall Street anyway. There's a notion that is coming from, the Bernie camp, which is the mere taking of the money is inherently corrupting. I mean, Bernie's sort of careful not to question Hillary's personal integrity, though Hillary then says, "You're using an artful smear and insinuation." So I'm not going to adjudicate Bernie's motivation. I know he clearly draws a line of how much he will say directly on that score. But he's definitely saying that the act of taking the money is inherently bad, therefore he won't do it. And there is a case to be made based on history that you can take that money and still regulate. Now, maybe you can't break up the banks. Maybe you can't, you know, send them to oblivion by taking some of their money. But it's not quite the same as them getting everything that they want by giving you that money. Then, so you can still come away from that and say, well, I want to break up the bank, so I don't want to take their money, so I can do that. And that's fine. That's where you end up. There does become the next question, which is, so how do you win the general? If Bernie's raised $75 million so far, probably more since New Hampshire, it was $75 million as of the end of 2015. Obama raised $1 billion in 2012, which matched what the Romney side had. And some people are estimating it's going to be more in 2016. You might need $1.5 billion, you might need $2 billion. So there's a big uncertain question that you can't really prove one way or the other in the primary stage. Can you raise that kind of money on a strictly small dollar, no super PAC strategy? At minimum, it's a gamble. You don't know how far the ceiling can go with what Bernie has right now. The Democratic logic for a while has been, we just got to beat these guys. So I'll take whatever money I can get so I can be competitive. Otherwise, we'll get drowned in campaign cash. And now that argument is getting overshadowed by the allure of doing it through fully pure means and small dollar only. So I don't know if you have a final thought there. If you think Bernie can go the distance with the way he's been doing it.
I think there's something to be said for the fact that Russ Feingold, who is kind of the big author of all of this anti-big money stuff, is saying he's going to take super PAC money in his Senate race because he wants to be on equal footing. Like, I think if you're going to play the game, you should play the game to win. But, you know, he's also, Bernie's raising so much money without doing it. So maybe he knows something we don't.
All right, well, it's been great to talk to you these past few weeks. Where can people find your future coverage on the campaign trail?
NationalReview.com or my Twitter feed, which is Alexis_Levinson.
Excellent. And I'm on Twitter at Bill Scherer, BILLSCHER. Look for that political piece that should be coming out in the next couple of days on the delegate fight on the Democratic side. And we got, I guess by the time this goes up, the Democrats might have already debated. Is there a Republican debate before South Carolina?
Saturday.
All right.
There's Saturday in Greenville. So tonight for the Democrats, Saturday for Republicans.
Will you be in Greenville?
I will not be in Greenville for that.
So when do you go to South Carolina?
Watching and tweeting sometime next week.
All right. So we'll be on the lookout for all your reporting. Till then, we'll see you next week here on the DMZ.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.